Welcome to Groundworks. This is Jean Allert with the Samaritan Women. In this episode, I'm very pleased to share with you a commentary on the document that was recently produced by the U.S. Department of Justice, Western District of Virginia. It was my honor to collaborate with some fine and exemplary professionals working in the field of anti-trafficking and the prosecution of trafficking offenders to produce the Residential Service Guide to Working with Law Enforcement Referrals of Human Trafficking Victims. We provided a link to the PDF so that you can download this complete document. What I'd like to do in this podcast is to just give you a little bit more about this publication and perhaps some additional perspective from the service provider's perspective. I hope, along with my colleagues, that you find this to be a very helpful publication in thinking through what type of agency you have serving human trafficking survivors and how you need to properly train your staff and develop internal protocols and policies so that you can work most effectively with law enforcement professionals. So I'm going to go page by page through the document, making comments as we proceed. So it would be helpful if you would pause this episode and download the document now. So let's go ahead and begin. I'm going to start with the introduction. The authors of this document encourage the service providers review this information to help assess the capacity of your particular program to serve human trafficking survivors and your ability to work most effectively with law enforcement. We start out helpfully with some definitions. And I think that it is important that we spend a little time talking about these distinctions because this language might be new for most of you. In this document, we refer to three different types of victims from a law enforcement perspective. Now, I know as a service provider that we tend to categorize victims between either labor trafficking or sex trafficking or perhaps the venue of the trafficking or perhaps by the age of the individual. But from a law enforcement perspective, you need to understand that we're talking about case-identified victims, court-involved victims, and court-supervised victims. Now, don't get hung up on the word victim. That's a legal term. That is not a pejorative label. It doesn't mean that the individual is perpetually victimized and will never get out of the victim mentality. It is a legal term that is important for you to understand and to work with when you're working with law enforcement. So a case-identified victim is somebody for whom they have identified is affiliated with a potential case that they expect to have ongoing communication with the individual and have an opportunity for formal interviews with the individual. They expect that this victim can also make contact with their law enforcement professional whenever they need to. This is somebody who needs to be able to have that kind of contact because law enforcement and the courts may still be determining whether or not they have a sufficient case. So ongoing communications is very important. If your facility has been defined as one in which you are, for their safety, cutting them off from contact, you perhaps might not be able to serve a case-identified victim. The second definition is a court-involved victim, and this is a person who's referred to an agency that has been identified by law enforcement as a victim in an active criminal investigation where court proceedings have been initiated. What that means is there's an active case pending for that individual. They are most likely going to be called to provide testimony in that particular case. Now, in some cases, I suppose that they could also be the defendant in that case. But court involved means that there is an actual case, it is pending, it's under investigation, and their appearances in a court involved case are mandatory. So you can't say that that victim is not going to be made available. Then the third definition is court-supervised victim. And this is for a court-involved victim who has regular reporting requirements or other conditions imposed by the court in a legal proceedings. Or in other words, this individual might be somebody on parole or probation, somebody who has been court-ordered into your program, somebody for whom there is still an affiliation with the court, and the court ultimately has supervision over the safety and the progress of that individual. So, that calls for a particular kind of relationship. Now, there are additional definitions represented in this document around page 2 and 3, like what do they mean by emergency placement versus stabilizing placement versus restorative placement. You can read those definitions on page 3 and 4, but they coincide nicely to our podcast on the different types of agencies. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through each of the criterion for law enforcement referral in each of the placement types, spending more time on emergency placement just because some of these conditions transcend all three types of placements. So when we're talking about emergency placement, we are talking about a law enforcement agency that needs to put a victim in a particular secure location for a short period of time, and the emphasis of that placement is on safety. Some of the factors that are brought forward in the document beginning on page 5 is that it's very important that any agency that is going to provide emergency placement, now you may call yourself a safe house, that's okay, it's the same thing. They want to make sure that in working with law enforcement, you have written criteria that addresses what is the profile of the type of victim that you are equipped to house. Can you house only single gender? Can you house male, female, transgendered? Do you have age limitations? Do you have limitations on the type of trafficking? Do you have limitations on the languages that you can support? Do you have any limitations on the type of victim? Again, using those definitions of case identified, court involved, or court supervised. And are there any other criterion associated with your agency that would it be important for law enforcement to understand? That might be things like, we don't allow them to be detoxing. We can't take anybody who's not sober. We limit medications. We are a faith-based organization. Those might be very important upfront considerations for law enforcement to have. What emergency placement facilities need to understand is that agencies have to respond very rapidly. They need to know that they can call you and that you're going to answer the phone. If you're an agency where they're going to go to voicemail, they're probably not going to call you again. So they need to be able to know that you are accessible and that you are going to be able to respond when the law enforcement professional calls you for that emergency placement. They want to make sure that you have established and written intake procedures. That means that you have outlined what it is that you are going to ask and what it is that you are going to require of someone that you're taking into your facility. On page 6, about middle of the page, you will see that the agency should have an intake procedure tailored to law enforcement referrals of trafficking victims. The question should be narrowly drafted to elicit only the information necessary for emergency placement. Let me make a couple of comments about this. There's a lot that we think we need to know on the shelter side that we don't need to know. And you have to train your staff and be very careful about what information you think is on a need-to-know basis. The agency should guard against leaving the victim with the impression that law enforcement is not to be trusted. Well, what do they mean by that? What they mean is when they bring a survivor to you, You don't usher that individual into another room, separating them from the law enforcement contact, suggesting by your body language and by the placement that now they're safe with you, but they weren't safe when they were with the law enforcement professional. You need to be in collaboration, and you need to convey in all ways that you are working as a team. The agency needs to agree to provide housing for a minimum of 5 business days. Now keep in mind, these are the parameters that are set forth by the Virginia Human Trafficking Task Force of the Western District. That may not be the same in your particular state or county. So you'll want to check with them about their expectations for how long short-term placement may be. I've known of many agencies that only had a 72-hour stay. What you have to understand from a law enforcement perspective is that what they need from you is to buy time. They cannot immediately determine what the victim's needs are. They need a little time and a place where that individual can be safe and can be taken care of, so that they can deem what is an appropriate stabilization place for the individual. The agency, meaning you, needs to have written policies in place for ensuring what that safety and stability is going to look like. On page 7, read the paragraph. The victim frequently feels unsure about cooperating with law enforcement and may be uneasy about trusting the service provider to meet their needs. This is a time of indecision and uncertainty, and the victim commonly considers leaving the emergency placement to either return to the trafficker or to try it on their own. This is absolutely the truth, and if you've been in this work for a while, you know it is true. This is a very volatile time for the victim, and so you need to provide constant reassurance that their decision to walk away from that situation, to escape that situation, to leave their trafficker, and to align themselves with protective services has been the right move. You have to be careful about not making promises you can't honor, but reassurance can be a good thing. You also have to be very mindful about what other communications the individual has with agencies or individuals outside of law enforcement. In these first couple of days, this can be a very tender thing to balance. You need to shield the victim from negative and destabilizing influences. He or she is going to be incredibly wavering in what is happening to me next, do I trust these people? Why should I believe them? I didn't believe the last person. Why should I believe them? And they are a swirl of thoughts, and they are hypervigilant, and they don't know why they should trust you or anybody else. And so the desire to move back to what they perceive to be safe or at least known is going to be very high. Service providers then should provide constant contact or regular updates to the law enforcement. You should be very open in your communications. Talk about the victim's behavior. Is the individual being particularly withdrawn? Are they very animated? Who are they making contact with? How are they responding to authority? These might all be critical elements to law enforcement in preparing the victim for what is to come. If there is going to be a case going forward, it's good for law enforcement to get a sense for how the individual is settling in and responding to the environment. You also need to pay attention to staff training and how well educated your staff is on law enforcement procedures and how the court proceedings can go. Because what many of us in the service provider community don't understand is that we can be called to testify based on what a victim tells us. Staff at the facility, by asking unnecessary questions about the details of the case, could become witnesses in court and subpoenaed to testify. Now, that's not meant to terrify you, it's meant to educate you that you have to understand that what you are drawing out of that individual with your questions could very well be the nature of the questions you're called to account for when called to court. I draw your attention to page 9. The agency, upon receiving a request from law enforcement, will provide reasonable access to the victim. It is often incredibly important to the building of rapport that the law enforcement investigator has direct, one-to-one, in-person contact with the victim. Now, this can be very troubling to a survivor, particularly if the survivor can recount stories of having bad encounters with police, of having a lot of distrust in their life. You have to help them overcome this. But it is so important, because that investigator or that victim advocate is going to be with them all the way through the case. And so anything that you can do to further that relationship is going to be better for the survivor as well as for the case. Now, there's a particular note in here that I think is worth calling out. It talks about the disclosure of the location of the facility. You know, unfortunately, Hollywood hasn't helped us by making us think that all of our facilities have to be undisclosed and that we have to have Liam Neeson sitting in the bushes, you know, waiting to take on anybody that's going to come near our victims. Well, realistically, for those of us who are in the stabilization or restorative type of work, that is seldom the case. But we can't make light of security. What we need to understand is that we can't exempt law enforcement from knowing where we are and knowing where the victim is. Some agencies, quite frankly, have become too full of themselves. And so they have said, well, I can't let anybody know where she is, as if law enforcement is going to cause him or her any harm. So I say that with some condemnation because, frankly, there are some people who have just not understood the importance of this relationship, and I'm encouraging you to develop a relationship with your law enforcement professionals so that that is a non-issue. Another thing that service providers often don't think of, if you look at item number 10 on page 9, is that sometimes placing two victims connected with the same history or the same case could pose significant risk to the integrity of their recovery and cause conflict with the case. They could collude with one another about their testimony, and that's a bad thing. It's not going to be helpful to them. So you will, as much as you might fight against it, want to share with your law enforcement referrers who else you have in your facility who might be affiliated with somebody they want to refer. The way we handle it is we ask in the pre-qualification phase whether or not the individual has been trafficked in any of the states contiguous to ours, whether or not they know the name of the trafficker, and then we can just check that against anybody that we have to see whether or not we think that there might be a conflict. It's also important that we work at this collaboratively from the standpoint of what law enforcement has to give us. You need to utilize these agencies for staff training. Don't think that you have to take that all on. If you want to have a great relationship with law enforcement, invite them in to educate your staff. Have them teach your staff about the criminal justice process, about law enforcement policies and restrictions, and where they are limited and where they have latitude, where they can provide services and where they can't. This is only going to make us work better together. So now let's move on to page 11, where we talk a bit about the stabilization placement. Now, here again, we are talking about the agency providing written criteria for the similar kind of information, the victim profile that you can handle, whether or not you can accommodate different types of law enforcement referrals, and whether or not you have any conditions within your placement that might limit someone or present a problem. So, for example, if you can only serve people of a particular language, a particular faith, a particular gender preference, etc., You need to communicate that up front so that you don't create a conflict. You need to understand that arrangements for stabilization placement often may occur at the same time that the law enforcement professional is finding them emergency placement. That's because they are working on so much time sensitivity. If they know that they've got maybe 3 days or 5 days to place somebody in an emergency capacity, they're going to want to already begin to line up what the stabilization placement is. So it is a fair question to say, where is he or she going now, and when do you anticipate her coming to us? What this human trafficking task force from the Western District of Virginia is looking for is that a stabilization placement would be a minimum of 30 days, and up to 90 days. Now, personally, I have seen a wide range of what constitutes stabilization. 30 days seems to be the minimum. I have seen up to 120 days. I have also seen agencies who say 6 months is temporary or stabilization or assessment placement. Now, because our industry doesn't have a solidified lexicon, you're just going to have to work with these differences in terminology. But essentially, the work that is happening in the stabilization phase is that the victim is detaching from their connections to the trafficking situation. They're starting to realize the depths of their trauma, what they've experienced, and they have begun, albeit at a small level, they have begun to envision a possibility for themselves. This is an enormously important period of time because it could be the make or break on whether or not this individual is, one, going to be a good witness, and two, going to be able to move on to more restorative care. Now, you'll see as you go through the guide that a number of the factors and criterion that they're advising are the same as for emergency placement. I will remind you that service providers need to be cognizant about the fact that they are not in a legally protected relationship with the victim. Unless you are a medical or mental health provider, you are not in a protected relationship, and so therefore your conversations with that individual can be subpoenaed for the court. If you look on page 15, there is an important piece of education for most of us outside of the law enforcement arena, and that is, for a federal case, it could be 18 to 24 months from victim identification to the conclusion of a prosecution. So we need to be in this for the long haul. Don't get caught up in the idea or the illusion of being the one that's going to capture all of the data and going to be able to get all the facts. It is very likely, and in our experience, that even within the period of stabilization, you're going to get a variety of scenarios. You are going to get truth and you are going to get deception. It's going to sometimes depend on the day. So be very careful about the fact that you are working through an evolving truth. All the more reason for you to have a tighter relationship with law enforcement and to just stay in touch. We have a tendency to keep in touch with the law enforcement contact or the court-affiliated contact to just say how a victim is doing on a month-by-month basis, almost like you would with a parole or probation officer, but just to let them know, she's struggling with this, he's having a hard time with that, we made a milestone here. That can all be important information. Don't also negate the fact that law enforcement can be helpful to you in case management and the coordination of services. There are certain things that they can leverage that might be outside of the bounds of what you can do. Couple more comments and then we'll wrap. Let's talk about restorative placements. And here we are talking about agencies that receive human trafficking survivors for a minimum of 30 days, but there really is no maximum at this point. Our particular program is at 2 years, but we're in fact extending to 4 years. So there is really no upper limit, but they still want written criteria for what your profile is, what you can accommodate in terms of type of referral, and any special conditions. Now, for restorative placements, you may need to say more about what your ebb and flow, your daily routine, your emphasis on recovery, what that looks like. In our organization, for example, church is just something that we do. Volunteering in the community is just something that we do. We co-mingle with volunteers. That's a part of our DNA. And we need to make sure that law enforcement understands that because they may have a victim for whom that is not well suited. Your referral may be coming, if you are a restorative placement, they may be coming from a stabilization shelter. They may be coming from a correctional facility or perhaps another housing situation. In most cases, they will know upwards of 30 days out whether or not they have somebody that they are trying to place in your location. So you've got a good deal of time to build up some understanding about this referral and to develop a rapport with the law enforcement professional. Now, in this particular document, they are suggesting that there's a minimum of 90 days placement for long-term, but as I've noted, some of our agencies go much, much longer. They do understand that restorative placement's ultimate goal is to set the victim on the path to self-sufficiency. And so what we're trying to do is to pour into these individuals so that they can realize a level of resiliency and independence. Keep in mind, though, if you have a one-year program and it can take 18 to 24 months before that individual's case goes to trial, they may continue to need support from you. This document also says not only is there a lead time in terms of making the referral, but it would greatly benefit law enforcement if you would be clear about how much notice you can give before you discharge an individual from your facility. Now, we know this is not always possible. Sometimes somebody gets a wild hair and they just gotta go. And they go. Sometimes somebody breaks a major offense and you've gotta let them go. If you have stayed in contact with your law enforcement in person, they will not be surprised when you say, "Yeah, we saw this brewing and she just walked on out." They know that that's going to happen, but stay in communication is going to make all the difference. On page 19, they talk about ways in which you can keep in touch with them and what the collaboration is going to look like. As I've noted, in addition to the contacts that they might have using the phone, using the internet, with anybody who's incarcerated, any contact with any individuals in a visit, in a family context, but we also provide information about those privileges and milestones so that the law enforcement agency understands more of the fullness of what that person is experiencing. There is a great hazard, and I'm going to repeat this for the third time because it's so important. There's a great hazard in those of us who are in the restorative work to become so family-like, so friendly, so attached to the survivor that we become casual. You have to guard against this. Conversations will take place that may reveal details, that may reveal information, that may retract something that was said prior, and that's going to be very important and information that can be disclosed in the court. So what we do is we keep a form called a record of conversation that at any time a staff person feels as though a resident has been overly disclosing, incredibly conflicted, really anything that would evoke a visceral reaction upon the staff, that they make a record of that conversation so that we have it, because memory will fade over time. On page 20, there is that mention about whether or not there's anybody else in your facility that might be connected to the referring individual that they are trying to place at your agency. One of the things that this document doesn't say, which is be worth for you to ask, is ask the law enforcement professional if the victim that they would like to place in your facility has any history of being a recruiter, of being a bottom girl, of being somebody who's an enforcer. That may be very important to the dynamic within your household. They will understand why you're asking that question. So make sure that you have that in your list of inquiries back to them. On page 21, it says that law enforcement will provide regular and appropriate updates regarding the criminal investigation. Don't assume that that means that you are going to be privy to all aspects of the case. You're not. But what they will do is let you know, at least within 3 business days, whether or not that individual is going to be called to testify, to be in court. You need to ask before that individual is even placed at your facility whether or not that individual is going to be expected to be transported to the court appearance. Are they allowed to travel alone? Do you require that they are chaperoned? Is the federal agency going to pay or local agency going to pay for the travel? In our situation, if it is required that one of our residents has to go out of state for a court appearance, we require that the court provide for funding for the travel and for the hotel stay, not only for the survivor, but also a separate room for the companion or the chaperone. So you will want to make those conditions known in advance for your law enforcement relationship. I'll conclude this discussion of the Residential Service Provider's Guide by asking you to go to page 23, where they have a couple of additional special considerations. One, you need to understand that if you are taking in somebody who is court-affiliated or case-affiliated, that ultimately law enforcement maintains responsibility for that victim. Again, do not assume that this is a baby left on your doorstep and you now have full responsibility and control over everything with that individual. You are working as partners with law enforcement. You're doing what you do best. They're doing what they do best. On this special considerations page, you will see some of the different areas of policy and protocol development that you'll want to make sure that you have written down. Let me just pull out a couple of them. For us, because we use a lot of volunteers in our organization, we have to make sure that we have documentation, complete background checks and identification, and nature of contact of all of our volunteers with our survivors. If you're going to use volunteers, you need to do the same. In our facility, we have 24/7 staff, meaning compensated staff coverage, so we can always account for who was in that supervisory relationship. But some facilities use volunteers, so you're going to want to make sure you adhere to the same standard whether the individual in supervision is paid or not paid. You're going to want to make sure you're clear about what confidentiality you uphold, what you know about the client and what the client is allowed to have confidential. You have to know that your documents are discoverable from the courts, and so you have to make sure that that is not only understood by your staff, but it's also something that you can make available. As we move to the end of the document, turn to page 24 for some final remarks. Some facility-specific rules for the expectation of victims. Initially, you may not think that these are that important, but they really are. If you have particular restrictions based on the type of program that you want to operate, restrictions such as no smoking or no consumption of certain types of foods or whether or not they can have family visits, or whether or not they can overnight stays, or whether or not they have personal possessions of a particular type. I'll give you an example. At our facility, we do not allow anybody to wear anything that is gang affiliated. They can't have any jewelry, any clothing, any insignia, short of a tattoo, that is gang related. They also can't wear anything that is hostile to any culture, any ethnicity, any religion. And so those are some of the conditions we have at our facility. As I mentioned before, we also have practices that we say, we go to church, we go volunteering, you will be expected to do chores. And those are conditions that you need to communicate up front. You also need to communicate them in writing so that they can be accurately passed along to the victim. Because as the victim advocate or the other law enforcement official is communicating with the victim about his or her choice on placement, they're going to be discussing these guidelines and conditions. So the more you have written down, the better that conversation will go. I'll make one last point about privileged conversation. As I've said before, there's no privileged communication or protected relationship in a federal case between your staff, if your staff includes case managers, service providers, volunteers, lay staff, hotline operators, intake counselors, etc. That's not privileged conversation. Only if the individual is a medical professional or a psychotherapist is there a confidential relationship that is not discoverable. So you need to educate your staff about that. Minimize the number of questions that you feel you need to ask about the trafficking situation and focus on their therapeutic care. In conclusion, I want to say that what we're talking about is building a truly collaborative relationship where the service provider is doing what it does well and the law enforcement professionals are doing what they do well. I hope that you reach out to the law enforcement professionals and court professionals in your area and foster this kind of collaborative relationship. I'd like to give acknowledgement to the peers that have worked with me through Homeland Security Investigations, the Henrico County Police Department, and the Fairfax County Police Department, and the Western District Human Trafficking Task Force, as well as the Department of Justice, to put together this guide, the Residential Service Provider's Guide to Working with Law Enforcement Referrals of Human Trafficking Victims. I hope you have enjoyed this podcast. I hope you find this document helpful, and please continue to join us for future episodes of Groundwork.